By the time this podcast comes out, we'll all be in the midst of yet another rainstorm. So if you're listening to this podcast, I hope you're staying safe, dry, and warm. Otherwise, hi, I'm Joel Garcia. Welcome to the Pop Culture Shuffle. On today's show, I have a few things to talk about. First up, considering the wet weather, I might as well talk about something similarly wet. DreamWorks' Ruby Gillman, Teenage Kraken. Then, we talk about a TV network that you probably never heard of, but is just as old as the CW. And finally, we're talking sports as we take a look at NASCAR's Clash at the Coliseum and how that whole thing went. But first, let's get in the ocean. Recently, I had the chance to finally watch DreamWorks' Ruby Gillman, Teenage Kraken. Now, some of you might recall that film from last year being the one that many saw as, DreamWorks' response to the Little Mermaid remake. Even though it wasn't. At all. For those unaware of the film, it centers around the titular character of Ruby Gillman, who is your standard teenage girl who also happens to be a Kraken. She lives on a coastal city alongside the rest of her family, who are all Krakens but live with humans. It also leads to conflicts with her mother, who refused to let her go out on a prom that'll be said on a boat in the ocean, and she forbids her daughter from ever going to the ocean for some reason. However, when an incident happens that forces her to go into the ocean to save someone, she winds up enabling something in her hands that ultimately turns her into a giant Kraken. It's at this point when Ruby meets her uncle, but also finds out that, she's royalty, and her grandma's alive, and the queen of the ocean, much to her mother's annoyance. Let's get the elephant in the room out of the way. If you see this film, you might think that it's a ripoff of Turning Red, similar to say how Ant is a ripoff of Bug's Life, or Shark Tale is a ripoff of Finding Nemo, neither of which is the case. Now sure, a Bug's Life and Ants, you can say, there's similarity because they're both about ants, but that's pretty much where that similarity ends. Same thing with Ruby Gillman, Teenage Kraken, and Turning Red. And just for the sake of not repeating myself over and over again, I'm just gonna say Ruby Gillman. Now in both Ruby Gillman and Turning Red, there is a situation involving the character transforming into something else, but it's a little different in Ruby Gillman, since in Turning Red, Mei Mei can turn from human to giant red panda, but in Ruby Gillman, she turns from Kraken to even bigger Kraken. She's not human at all. The only other similarity it has to Turning Red is simply how the Kraken power works. Because in Turning Red, we only see that the ability to turn into a giant red panda is inherited by all the women in the family. Similarly, in Ruby Gillman, the film straight up tells you that only the women can turn into giant female Kraken, not the men. I feel like that was a big problem because it was a question that Turning Red straight up avoided. Literally, the closest it ever got to setting up a question of, can the men turn into giant pandas, is only in a deleted scene in which Mei Mei meets her male cousin. But other than that, it just didn't bother with the question. Whereas Ruby Gillman just shows you that when they're under the sea, the male Kraken don't change much in size, whereas the women Kraken turn into kaiju. As in, like, they turned to freaking Godzilla. I will give the film that, at least it didn't acknowledge that question, but at the same time, left a lot of plot holes. Probably the biggest one that bothered me was one involving Ruby and her mom, because her mom doesn't want Ruby to go into the ocean. Which begs the question, if she didn't want Ruby to go into the ocean, why do you live in a coastal city? The film strangely did acknowledge this problem by simply having a discussion between Ruby's mom and her brother, in which her brother straight up asks, "Wait, if you don't want to live in the ocean, why do you live here?" And the mom says, "Oh, because we have to be moist." So that just raises another question of, why didn't you find a place that has a pool or something water related that isn't the ocean? Because otherwise, this whole film falls apart. Now, the reason I refuse to say that it's a Turning Red ripoff is because while there are elements that seem reminiscent of Turning Red, such as the climax, but certain elements are not presented in the exact same way. Take, for example, how their friends react to their best friend's transformation. In Turning Red, Mei Mei's friends are at first shocked to see her turn into a giant red panda, but quickly accept it and in fact have fun with it. Whereas in Ruby Gilman, her three best friends never find out about this until the end, right after the climax. And when Ruby does reveal herself to her friends, they're like, "Oh, that's nice, we respect you." That moment was frankly lame. Because of all the ways you'd think her friends would react with something like, "Oh wow," or "Oh my god," they just react with, "Yeah, that's cool." As if this is just something normal for them. This is like finding out Clark Kent is Superman and then just saying, "Yeah, that's cool, where's my coffee?" Now there's more I could bring up, like how characters are wasted in this story, or even just, well, Nerissa. And by that I mean Queen Nerissa, the evil queen of the mermaids, or aka not Ariel. Because that's literally the only thing most people will remember about this film. I recall seeing fan art for this character months before the film came out. Everyone just trying to dunk on the Little Mermaid remake and just saying, "Oh, this film's gonna beat the Little Mermaid at the box office." It didn't. And then just making jokes about how, this is the original Ariel who went from being in the anime film, found out she got fired, and went to work for DreamWorks. Which is a really dumb joke, by the way. And I recall seeing these memes online in which she's part of the Spider-Man pointing reference, in which it's like she's pointing at the remake Ariel, who's pointing at the animated Ariel, and for some reason, pointing at the Ariel laundry detergent. I recall at one point just pointing out the issue in which everyone's like, "Oh yeah, you're praising this character, but she's not the main character of the film." As for the character itself in the actual film, Nerissa is just basically your stereotypical mean girl who tries to act nice and friendly to Ruby, but at the same time is frankly underwhelming as a character because she acts as, the happy-go-lucky best friend. But at the same time, you already know this character is the bad guy. How do I know this? Because the trailer straight up spoils the narrative. For some reason in the trailer, they have a sequence from the final fight. And you can clearly tell that's supposed to be Nerissa because she's literally the only mermaid in the film. When it comes to the film's marketing, it just straight up ruined everything because I remember seeing a trailer for the film right before the Little Mermaid remake. And one of the lines they chose to highlight in the trailer was about the mermaids, in which Ruby's grandma says, "Anyone who likes mermaids is stupid." Which is probably not the best way to convince people to go see your movie if they're about to see the Little Mermaid. Because basically, the movie was telling them, "Hey, are you gonna see a movie about mermaids? Well, you're a fucking idiot!" I mean, it's one thing to make fun of the competition, and DreamWorks has done that a lot, but it's a completely different thing to call your potential audience morons. I've also freely admit that a lot of the film just came down to the fact that it was boring. Apparently, the filmmakers were inspired by films such as Booksmart and Easy A, and while I've never seen Booksmart, I have seen Easy A, and I really don't know where that comes from. Like, sure, there are elements that are reminiscent of Easy A, but not the manner that it's executed. Yes, both films are in high school. Both films feature someone trying to stand out. But that's pretty much it. I feel like the best way to sum up this film is that it's very unoriginal. I feel like that's the worst nightmare for any film. I mean, there are elements in it that really could work to make it a very unique film, but then again, there are other films that did a much better job of executing this premise, especially Turning Red. And sure, the way it gets there is different, But you really can't get away from the comparison. Especially because Turning Red's story was great, had this dynamic between Mei Mei and her mom. But here in Ruby Gilman, it's mostly about like, oh yeah, she has a problem with her mom. But at the same time, she also had an issue with her grandma, the mermaid, high school, and like, they're just too much. Turning Red at least knew where to stop the story. It knew when to focus on what characters at what time. It focused more on Mei Mei's friendships and family issues than just say, oh, what about high school? What about this person? What about this person? And I feel like that's the biggest problem with Ruby Gilman. It just has too much going for it. And in the end, you're just left with a film that will sadly be marked as yet another attempt at ripping off Disney. Whether it's The Little Mermaid or Turning Red. Or both. Overall, Ruby Gilman is a film that really tries its best to be something original, but in the end, you'll probably just see it as something derivative, and that other films did a better job of executing the premise, the tone, the concept, literally everything about it. I personally can't even recommend the film because it's not that good. It's decent, but not great. Personally, I would just recommend seeing Turning Red. Not only is that film available to stream on Disney Plus and own on 4K, Blu-ray, DVD, and digital, but it's about to be released at theaters for the first time ever, so I'd recommend checking that film out. Otherwise, Ruby Gilman is available to own on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital, as well as stream on Peacock. As I previously talked about the CW several times, I might as well talk about the other broadcast network that also launched in 2006, My Network TV. Some of you might have either never heard of that network, or probably recall once hearing the My Something TV branding long ago. Well, the CW was a merger of the WB and UPN. My Network TV's conception had to do with its aftermath. And it's gonna get a little complicated because we're gonna talk about local TV logistics here. But I'll try and be brief. When it came time to deciding which of the former network's affiliates would pick up the CW, it mostly came down to which network owned the respective station. Such as the UPN affiliate in Atlanta owned by CBS, or the WB affiliate owned in Los Angeles by outgoing WB owner Tribune. Half of their affiliates were left without any affiliation, including those owned by a certain rival. This leads us to Fox Television Stations, which as the name would indicate, own and operate several major Fox affiliates around the country. Some, such as KTTV 11 in Los Angeles and WNYW 5 in New York City, were launch affiliates for Fox. In the early 2000s, Fox acquired several UPN affiliates that notably included flagship stations in both New York and Los Angeles. During the aforementioned merger, none of them would acquire the CW, with the affiliation instead being given to the WB stations in those markets. This led Fox, and by extension their corporate owner News Corporation, to launch My Network TV for their outgoing UPN affiliates. It was also happily picked up by other soon-to-be former UPN and WB affiliates. Certain stations also picked it up to complement their regular programming. Over in the Imperial Valley, which never had a local UPN affiliate, my hometown Fox affiliate, KECY9, picked up My Network TV and would air it right after Fox's own primetime programming, basically giving them 4 hours of primetime on weeknights. My Network TV officially launched on September 5th, 2006, 2 weeks before UPN and the WB shut down. I recall watching the network's opening night, mostly out of curiosity. That and because I never got UPN and the WB locally, and the CW for a few years, at least until it came around on digital. When it first began, the network stood out by airing nightly soap dramas such as Desire and Fashion House. Think Days of Our Lives, but at night. They were desperately trying to be throwbacks to classic 80s dramas like Dynasty, but had the level of quality one would see in softcore pornography with cheap sets and corny dialogue. The only thing it was missing was the obligatory nudity prevalent in those productions. The most memorable thing I can recall from these shows was Morgan Fairchild, who was wasted on Fashion House in what sadly remains her last major starring role on TV to this very day. I tried to enjoy these soaps, but I wound up dropping them after a few episodes. Fox also eventually gave up on them as well. After having aired 6 of them over the network's first year, My Network TV began airing content that can be summed up in one word: desperate. This included a plethora of reality TV, syndicated game shows, films on the weekends, and sports. Now, unlike the CW, when it came to sports, it was solely pre-recorded content that could easily fill 2 hours, such as beach volleyball and mixed martial arts. At one point, they simply aired a special weekly edition of NFL Total Access, which, if you are unaware, is a long-running news program that continues to air to this very day on the NFL Network. I vividly recall watching their one and only sitcom, Under One Roof, which starred rapper/reality TV star Flava Flav. The most notable thing I can say about it was that Kelly Perrine from One on One was his co-star, and that it wasn't funny. The biggest thing My Network TV would ever air was WWE's Friday Night SmackDown. It began airing the wrestling show in 2008, right after having been dumped by the CW, coincidentally reuniting it with some former UPN affiliates. From what I looked up, mostly on Wikipedia, it did give the network their highest ratings ever, with the only thing apparently ranking just as high being an airing of the first Home Alone. So yeah, the ratings were that bad. By the time WWE ditched My Network TV for the Sci-Fi Channel in 2010, the network was no longer trying to compete with the CW, or any broadcast network. Rather than air news shows, they simply began airing reruns. This included such shows as Law & Order Criminal Intent, the 2002 revival of The Twilight Zone, Burn Notice, Bones, and The Walking Dead. In certain cases, reruns of said shows ran while they were still airing new episodes elsewhere. Bones in particular was on My Network TV while that show's final 3 seasons were airing over on Fox. My Network TV can't even be called a network anymore, with most places online now calling it a syndication channel or service. The best way to compare its current situation is with channels such as ION, Comet, or MeTV, which tend to solely air rerun marathons with little to no original content, such as ION sports coverage. Nowadays, if you were to tune in to My Network TV, their lineup consists of only 4 shows airing weekdays. They long ago dropped Saturday: Law & Order SBU, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, and Dateline, all 4 of which concurrently air over on NBC and Peacock. It gets even weirder because all 4 shows also air reruns over on NBC's sister cable channel, USA, and the former 3 air daily rerun marathons over on ION. Now, some of you might not even know if My Network TV is available in your area, which is understandable. Several of the stations which began airing the channel when it launched back in 2006 have either long dropped it outright or pushed it to a later time. Rather than air at, say, the standard 8 to 10 p.m. time slot for primetime, it can now be airing anywhere from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Here in San Diego, for example, the My Network TV affiliation is actually maintained by the CW San Diego, which we previously talked about. They currently air My Network TV programming from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m., meaning that the only people who would be up to watch that block would be anyone either still watching late night or waiting for the CBS overnight news. The Mind Network TV branding has also been decreased by Fox itself. Their LA affiliate, KCOP 13, once branded itself as My 13, but nowadays it is Fox 11 Plus, serving as an extension to its namesake sister station. Considering how My Network TV has gone from being an alternative to the CW to nothing but reruns, why is it still around? Apparently, it still makes money. A 2019 Deadline article about the channel states that it has been profitable for News Corp by its ad revenue, regardless of the aforementioned fact their shows can be seen elsewhere. A secondary reason brought up in the article is how Fox's owned and operated affiliates could take advantage of their sister stations whenever the Fox network has to air live sports coverage. Basically, My Network TV has gone from being an actual network to the TV equivalent of a turnkey business. For anyone interested in such an affiliation, they are guaranteed 10 hours of primetime programming with none of the standard network commitments such as national news or sports. It is a tempting offer for any affiliate who may want to focus much more on local programming and or other syndicated content. On the other hand, it just seems cheap and lazy. I see My Network TV as wasted potential. In the same way the CW could have been used by CBS and Warner Brothers to air their respective sports coverage, Fox could have used My Network TV in a similar manner. It probably would have helped them during major scheduling conflicts, such as when they had to simultaneously air either NASCAR, college football, or Major League Baseball on either Fox or FS1. Seriously, if your game is about to start on either network and the preceding event is nowhere near over, good luck trying to find FS2 or Fox Business. Or worse, the Fox Sports app. Personally, I think the ongoing existence of My Network TV is a paradox. I get why Fox and the network's affiliate enjoy having it around. They all get to make some money off the ad revenue without dealing with the hassle of having to produce original content. I think Fox could have at least done something with the network before giving up on it. The CW was still able to survive after all these years despite its profitability issues. As time goes on, and the prevalence and rise of digital sub-channels that air a wide range of reruns and free streaming services like Pluto TV, I really don't see a future for My Network TV. The only way it can possibly survive is if Fox revamped the network, such as adding sports or reruns of their ongoing series. Apart from that, My Network TV will continue to be just as relevant as a dead horse. If you're someone who rarely watches Law & Order SBU, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, or Dateline, you might enjoy the network. Alternatively, just subscribe to Peacock. The former three are able to stream in their entirety on the app, and the latter even has its own 24-hour channel. Otherwise, My Network TV airs nationwide. Check your local listings to see if the station is available in your area. Finally, rather than talk about the NFL Pro Bowl games, I wanted to talk about instead the other event that was supposed to happen on Sunday. NASCAR's Clash at the Coliseum. Now, I say was supposed to happen because, as originally intended, NASCAR was supposed to hold 2 days of racing at the LA Memorial Coliseum, with the whole plan being that on Saturday, there'd be some practice, qualifying for the Mexico Series race, and then some heat races, with the whole thing culminating on Sunday with both the Mexico Series race and then the Cup race on Fox. I remember being at Costco just like in the process of getting ready a few things, thinking I'm gonna watch the race on Sunday and it'll be great, and then I got this crazy alert from NASCAR saying that rather than say postpone the race due to rain on Sunday, they're gonna move the race up to Saturday night. So basically, the race was supposed to be held Sunday night is now on Saturday night, and it's something unexpected. Now, there's nothing new about NASCAR rescheduling a race or starting it slightly earlier. They've done this several times over the years, especially when there's a risk of a rain delay and they want to get the race in as soon as possible. But normally it's done with the intention of, oh, we're starting half an hour earlier or just in time for the network to start airing the race. So if anything, the worst thing that could happen would just be the loss of the pre-race broadcast and you wouldn't see the performance of the anthem or just drivers start your engines. But this was unusual because NASCAR pushed the race up by a day, which is a whole logistical nightmare that somehow worked out. Now it did help that FS1 was opposed to air practice and qualifying, so NASCAR took advantage of that window of opportunity to simply start the race there. And it did lead to a bit of chaos, especially if you were a fan of Xavier or DePaul basketball, because I feel bad for those people because they probably were expecting to watch a basketball game, only to then suddenly see, for at least the first few minutes, the end of a NASCAR race that wasn't supposed to be held that night. And I'll give this to NASCAR. They did their best in trying to get this race in. Even if, admittedly, they had to pull out a lot of the pomp and circumstance. There was supposed to be, this boxer for Grand Marshal. MGK was supposed to sing at halftime. And that didn't happen. I don't know what happened to the boxer, but with MGK, they just simply canceled his halftime performance. I heard this online, and I refuse to believe it's true. That when NASCAR announced that MGK wasn't performing, the fans cheered. Which is a weird thing to react to. Like, normally you don't hear people celebrating that something they came to see got canceled. Then again, it does make sense because NASCAR is just trying to hurry things up. It honestly felt that way for the most part. Like, literally the only time they stopped was, say, halftime, and that was it. Because you can clearly tell that NASCAR just wanted to get this out of the way. And it's understandable because if you don't live in Los Angeles or anywhere in Southern California, we've been dealing with a lot of rain lately, and we're just dealing with, like, I think the third or fourth final set of rain before it stops for a while. I believe NASCAR did the right thing in just simply moving the race up a day, even if it did cost them a lot. Since obviously, rather than air the race Sunday night on Fox, they wound up having to air it abruptly Saturday night on FS1. And there's a huge difference between airing something Saturday night on cable versus Sunday night on broadcast TV, especially at the very last moment. I mean, for all I know, maybe someone's going to tune in Sunday night and then be shocked to find a rerun of The Simpsons, or Krapopolis, or whatever other show Fox puts on that night. As for the race itself, I will give it this. It was decent, and not as chaotic as the first 2 years, but you can clearly tell that the drivers were not ready for this. And it was something I was hearing throughout practice, because I heard the practice broadcast on Sirius XM, and the announcers were talking about how, these cars feel very slow, they're not ready. And that's perfectly understandable because this is literally the first time these cars are running on a racetrack in a practice. Besides, say, the single car practice they've probably done between November and now. And with the last two exhibition races at the Coliseum, there was a situation where it just felt like they just threw them in and ran. But here, it was especially obvious. And it got to the point where maybe they really should move this race out of the Coliseum. And I know that it's a really complicated question of what to do with the Clash. There are people who say, let's bring it back to Daytona, but no. I get why people want it back at Daytona, but Daytona already has enough. They have the twin races, they have the 500, the 400. It's nice to just give the Clash to someone else. Similar to how the All-Star Race was held in a bunch of places before they decided on North Wilkesboro. We'll get to the rumor in a moment, but the race itself was fine, even if it wasn't that competitive. I mean, I'm glad that Denny Hamlin won, but other than that, it just wasn't a very interesting race, especially because a lot of the star talent people wanted to see probably didn't make it in. I was personally eager to see Daniel Suarez in the race, since he was competing in not just this race, but also the NASCAR Mexico Series race. and I was really disappointed he didn't make it in. But in the end, I was glad he won the Mexico Series race, which we'll get to in a moment because that had its own set of weirdness. If this was the last time they ever held the race at the Coliseum, I'd miss it a bit, but it wouldn't be a big loss. I mean, compared to other tracks that have held exhibition events, it's really hard to say if it was that memorable. Like, yes, it was unique that they held the race inside a football stadium, but there's only so much you can do with such a small space. So I'm just pretty mixed about this, because on the one end, it was a unique place to race, and I would have loved to go see a race there. But in the end, I get the feeling that unless there's a huge demand for it, I don't see it coming back to Los Angeles. At least not in the Coliseum. I honestly, the only way I could see NASCAR coming back to Los Angeles is maybe if they're running as a street circuit. Now, after the Cup race, there was also the Mexico Series race. And it was really interesting seeing how many people either never heard of the NASCAR Mexico Series or were discovering it for the first time. For those unaware, NASCAR has a series in Mexico. It's simply titled the NASCAR Mexico Series, and it consists of drivers competing in Mexico on a wide range of tracks around the country. And the race they held in Los Angeles was only the second race they've ever run in the United States, the last time being a race in Phoenix, which coincidentally was won by Daniel Suarez. Now, I feel like the NASCAR Mexico Series barely gets any attention because other than the two times they've run in the US, most people tend not to know about that series. And it's really disappointing because they do run in a wide range of tracks that NASCAR has never been to, other than the Autodromo in Mexico City. Putting this race alongside the Cup Series race was a really great way to introduce people to the Mexico Series, especially because, other than these special races in the US, the Mexico Series is pretty much ignored by everyone unless, say, oh, a driver from the Mexico Series is running. It was really interesting seeing people's reactions to this race because, for some reason, NASCAR didn't block the video on the Mexico Series YouTube channel, which they do have one. It's the NASCAR Mexico Series YouTube channel, and it streams every single race. So there was this weird moment in which the English broadcast was on FS2, while the Mexican broadcast was being streamed on YouTube. Because in Mexico, the race is also broadcast by four different channels, including Claro Sports. And it was just really fun seeing a bunch of NASCAR fans who've never heard of the Mexico Series be amazed by this broadcast. Either just by how, oh, the talent is being more energetic than the Fox crew. Nothing against Adam Alexander, who is a really good announcer, but Michael Waltrip can be kind of boring. And it was just funny seeing people get upset, being like, ugh, Michael Waltrip is so boring. Why isn't he like the other guy in the Spanish feed? It also made me very hopeful that maybe in the future, if NASCAR is able to get a race in Mexico, they really should do it alongside the Mexico Series. Just have like either the Cup, Xfinity, or Truck Series run a race in Mexico right alongside the Mexico Series. Which leads me to the rumor people are bringing up about the Clash. Now, this race was the last in a 3-year contract with the LA Coliseum, as far as I know. And supposedly, there are rumors that NASCAR might move the Clash to Mexico to run it either in Mexico City or in Guadalajara, where they also have a racetrack that apparently, as far as I can tell, the NASCAR Mexico Series has never been to. Yet. While it would be interesting to see NASCAR run exhibition race either with the Cup, Xfinity, or Truck Series in Mexico, I personally feel it would be much more exciting to see them run a regular season race. It's been done before with both the Xfinity and Truck Series. Some of my favorite races from the early 2000s were the Mexico City races the Xfinity, then Busch Series, ran at the Autodromo. It was just exciting to see them run in Mexico City because it was something brand new and incredible. And there's also Canada. Canada has seen a few regular season races from both the Xfinity and Truck Series. One of my favorite finishes from the Truck Series involved, I forgot who the other guy was, but it was also John Hunter Nemechek, and they were just beating and banging each other right down to the end, And right as they hit the home stretch, they were still crashing, so nobody knew who won the race. And when one of them tried to get the flag, the other just straight up tackled him to the ground, which is something you don't expect to see in a NASCAR race. So if the rumors are true that the Clash might move to Mexico, that would be interesting, but again, I would prefer a regular points race. If there's an issue that there's already too many races on the schedule, or that you don't want your favorite track to lose a race, that's a whole other story, but I just think it would be exciting. I mean, I feel like there is a way that we can have street racing in Chicago, a race in Mexico, a race in Canada. There is a way to do that. Sure, you might have to lose one or two races, but at the same time, it's possible. So when it comes to NASCAR, of course, next week is the Super Bowl, so the next race will be the Daytona 500. So Daytona Speed Weeks and all that, that happens in 2 weeks. You can tune in to the Daytona 500 Sunday, February 18th on Fox. Oh, and the NFC won the Pro Bowl games 64-59. I didn't watch it, like at all. I had better things to do in my Sunday afternoon, like go grocery shopping. And on that note, that is all the time we have for today's show. If you would like to know when the next episode comes out, remember to follow or subscribe to the podcast on your favorite stream provider. You can also follow me on Instagram, Threads, and X/Twitter at MrJoelGarcia9, as well as at MrJoelGarcia on TikTok. Until next time, thank you for listening.